Welcome to That's High Praise, a Nicolas Cage podcast.
I am your host, VH Zest.
And I'm your other co-host, Captain Nostalgia.
Cool. Yeah. So, Josh, to start this off this month, I just have one question. Which would you rather watch, reruns of Mr. Ed or the opera?
Do I get to pick which opera I'm watching? Or is it just the opera in general?
It cannot be a rock opera. There are no cheat codes out of this one.
All right, then Mr. Ed. I'm not a huge fan of Mr. Ed, but I would much prefer it over opera.
Fair enough. I like Mr. Ed, but I've never been to an opera, so I feel like to be objective, I would have to choose an opera, and then thereafter revisit the question.
That's fair. I've never been to an opera either, but I'm very selective with like the musicals that I like.
That's fair. Yeah,
and most people are. Opera is kind of like this, like, takes the concept of musical and then some. But, like, if I see it, like, I'd want to see it, like, in, like, Italy or, like, it would have to be, in a country, not America, that is famous for, like, opera.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. That'd be interesting. Yeah, that'd be, like, I don't really want to go to, like, a soccer game. But if I could go see a soccer game, like, in Germany or something, I probably totally would.
I've been to a soccer game. It's an all right
time. I
mean,
I've been to soccer games, like, my friends. Like
No. I've been to a professional soccer game.
That's pretty cool.
I mean, it was cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw a football game once, like an NFL game. And it was a cool experience, but it didn't make me like football.
Same.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, so we thought that this month is a natural extension of our conversation from the unbearable weight of massive talent that the poster is currently sitting behind me. Thank you, Alamo. That we would be doing a
Josh,
movie. What?
Remember the Alamo.
Remember the Alamo. That has a rather large Easter egg attached to one of its characters. What movie are we doing this month, Micah?
Yeah, we're doing a little movie called, it's a 1994 kind of like comedy drama called Guarding Tess.
Yeah, so when we get to the end portion of this, we're gonna I want to do like a sudden showdown and see like which 94 Cage is better. It Could Happen to You or Guarding Tess.
Okay. Fair enough. I will prepare mentally for that. Cool. Yeah, so this movie, basically the gist of this movie is Nicolas Cage, whom we know and love, plays a Secret Service agent, like reports to the head of the Secret Service, gets phone calls from like the president himself multiple times in the movie. Like that's his character. And he is charged with the protection of like the detail of a former first lady. Her, you find out later on in the movie that her husband, actually, I believe they painted it to make it like he actually died while still in office. And so apparently that's this whole thing. I don't know if this is a real thing or not. I didn't research that, but like apparently it's a thing, at least in this movie, where like if you are a former, shall we say, American royalty, you get a guard detail. So that is basically the gist of this movie.
And Tess is played by Shirley MacLaine, which is she's kind of Hollywood royalty in her own sense. So it's rather interesting to see her playing a character like Tess. Let's jump into general thoughts.
Yeah, so generally speaking, gosh, how to give general thoughts without being like too decisive or critical or anything. This movie had some really fun parts. This movie had just some really silly kind of fun interactions. There weren't a whole lot of early 90s Nicolas Cage isms. You see it like maybe twice where he's just like real over the top, you know. You see it like once in the first act, once in the third act, and that's like pretty much it. But it's got some really fun dynamics, I think, between this very young Nick Cage and this kind of like aging political figure who is just, she's very set in her ways. She very wants what she wants, and it doesn't matter to her whether she's supposed to have it or not. And it's, yeah, it's kind of fun. It's got some fun parts. It's got some parts where it's like, I don't really know how relevant this is, but yeah.
I will say this movie's delightful.
Sure.
This movie is problematic in a lot of ways when it comes to the narrative.
Yeah.
But it is problematic. It is delightful nonetheless. I really enjoy Nicolas Cage's arc throughout the course of this movie. I enjoy their banter. I thought that this movie has a lot of fun to offer. But I don't know necessarily if I would... I guess I won't say that because I feel like that ruins where I stand. I will say that this is not a movie necessarily that I would come back to, I feel like.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's anything about this movie that attaches me to the movie, whether that has to do with roles or plot or even just humor. It is a comedy for the most part. There's some dramatic parts, you know, as any movie, but it's for the most part, it's kind of like a weird... We thought it was going to be a family movie. It really wasn't, I don't think.
Oh, I just looked it up on... I initially thought it was going to be PG, and it's actually PG-13.
Okay. I was going to say, like not even an act of the movie, I was like, there are a lot of words in this movie that aren't generally in family movies in the early 90s.
And then Nicolas Cage drops an F-bomb per the PG-13 right before he shoots a guy's toe off.
Yep, that's true. Yeah, that does happen. Yeah. yeah, this movie's all right, though. It's very interesting. So it starts, and Nicolas Cage is like leaving this woman's house. They don't show her face. There's a lot of really satisfying buildup in this movie at the beginning. They don't show the face of the person that he's detailing, and then he goes back to the White House, and he reports to his boss, and he's like, the president called, you know, like in true Powerpuff Girls fashion. And he's like, he wants you to go back for another 3 years for, you know, to guard Tess, really. They don't say that, but, yeah. And he's like, sir, I don't want to go back for 3 minutes. And he's like, well, I can either tell the president that you're saying no, or you can go back. I'll give you a minute to think about it. And the next scene, he's like walking back through her door.
Which, can we kind of talk about that from a mental health perspective, both of us have worked in toxic work environments.
Sure.
And like the first, I will say the first like half of this movie, it sets up a very toxic work environment. You get an understanding, like you're saying, like there's a lot of satisfying build up that really does pay off, and it is really satisfying, but also at the same time, you also get on the flip side of that, you also get to understand why Nicolas Cage's character Doug doesn't necessarily like working here.
Yeah.
And my heart like really broke for him, man, because like, you know, he's in a position where he can't necessarily say no. And I've been in toxic work situations where like I couldn't necessarily quit just because I didn't have something else lined up and I had bills to pay.
Right.
You know, life of a bachelor.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the interesting thing about this movie, the interesting thing to me in general about jobs like butler, guard, maid, housekeeper, maybe not nanny, but maybe or nurse, things like that, is like you've got these jobs with like, it's almost like it's a built-in toxic work environment, and it's a built-in thing. The driver was even kind of like this. It's like a built-in toxic work environment because you're allowing yourself to be paid to have someone tell you what to do regardless.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's just like, hey, sometimes you just got to pay the bills, or sometimes you just, life dealt you a weird hand and now you're stuck with a very specific skill set and here you freaking are. Which they allude to in the movie later on. You know, but I think it's also interesting because like, I think those are the only jobs that I can think of where it's like, your responsibility is to listen to your boss. Your boss is your employer, the person you're taking care of. The responsibility of the employer is to be taken care of by you. And it's this really weird, like,
dynamic
give and take, almost like you're in a relationship with this person for a paycheck, period. Like, that's more or less the gimmick here.
Yeah, it's really weird, the dynamic that you kind of get. And, you know, I think we're both comic nerds.
Sure.
So, like, I think in the case of, like, Alfred Pennyworth.
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Is a great example. Yeah. Like, here you have a guy that, like, went off to war and, like, saw the darkest of humanity, and his dad died, and he kind of just, like, stepped into that role.
Yeah.
Stepped into that lifestyle. But in the Wayne's case, like, here you have people that genuinely care about the city. They genuinely care about the people that is staff underneath them. So, like, I don't necessarily would say that's, like, a toxic work environment. I think that would be, like, the one exception that I think you could you know, point to. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, like, there are, you know, tons of toxic work environments.
Yeah.
Where you kind of see it, and it, you know, we're led to kind of believe throughout the course of this narrative that, you know, Tess is a woman that she's a widower. Mm-hmm. And or a widow,
she's
sorry.
A widow, yeah.
She's a widow, and she essentially hasn't left the house in 5 years because of this depression with her the loss of her husband.
Yeah.
And, you know, so what do? You essentially kind of just turn to the people that are around you, and you're essentially toxic.
Yeah, I think what it comes down to, what I was thinking about it when we were watching the movie, is I was just like, what we're watching is like someone who, to them, control is security.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to, where something massive in their life, more than one thing, which you find out later on, massive in their life happens and it derails them, and it does not put them in a better place than they were in. It puts them in a worse place, and what they hold on to are things that don't like to turn them into really coarse people, but there are things that help them feel some sense of adjustment to the life that they are now thrust into.
Yeah, I think that it goes back to the old saying, like, you either get better or you get bitter.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And depression has this way of either embittering us to the people around us. Like, we intend to, instead of, like, loving them and appreciating them, we have this tendency to tolerate them. And that is kind of where the bitterness comes in. You either, or you recognize that you have a problem and you start to appreciate those that are around you. That's another thing that I really enjoyed about the ending of this movie. Yeah. Is the fact that, like, Tess actually goes through this, like, really traumatic experience and then happens to just kind of really value and appreciate Doug and really grows to love and appreciate him.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Bless you.
Thank you.
Let me count you in.
Yeah. I think it doesn't go without some tete-a-tete. You know, I think, like, Cage's character, Doug, you know, when he accepts the detail again for 3 years going into this quote-unquote relationship, you know, the job, and you see him be like, all right, I'm going to go back into this. I know her. I'm going to approach this like it's my job, not like I'm just, like, you know, some wait staff, if you will. Because sure. The first thing you ever see him do in the movie is bring her breakfast. And so you see him, like, the biggest thing that, like, really, there's this pivotal moment where she wants to go out, and so they get in the car, and she sits on the driver's side of the car in the back seat, and she's not supposed to, according to, like Secret Service regulation. The escortee is supposed to sit in a position where the passenger and the driver can see them, and she refuses to, and she orders her driver, or no, Cage, Doug character, orders the driver to turn off the car, and she orders him to turn on the car, and he hesitates, and Doug, the Doug character, is like, he explains the regulation to her, and he's like, now, we're not going to go anywhere until you sit in the correct seat, and it's really tense, and then she finally, like, huffs and does it, and at that point, it's just like, you really begin to understand the direction the movie is taking, and the dynamic that is, like, forming, and that the Doug character realizes that, like, all right, if this is the way it's going to be, then I'm going to make it the best that I can make it instead of just bending over.
Yeah, there's also another great scene that it kind of echoes what you're saying is the golf scene where she essentially is like, you know, hey, like, she wants to go golfing middle winter, and she hits a ball, goes somewhere, and he's basically summoned to be a caddy.
Yeah.
And he kind of tells her off. And that's like the first or second day after he returns. But I think you're absolutely right in what you're talking about, you know, about how it is it is a toxic work environment, and you kind of have to, you know, grow to be better or to kind of move away from it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. And sometimes, like, man, this is something I feel like it's come up a lot in my life over the past several months, maybe even several years if I had really thought about it, of like, sometimes you just got to have boundaries. Sometimes you got to learn how to say no. And it is what is often best for your relationships, and what you struggle with, what I struggle with. I can't put that on other people. What I struggle with is feeling like it is not good for relationships. I feel like, oh, me saying no, me shutting people out, me having boundaries, that looks like, to me, that often looks like and feels like isolation, and it feels like bitterness or things like that. And it's like, no, it doesn't have to be any of those things. Sometimes it's just like knowing your position and what your position has been and what it could be and needs to be for, like, your betterment and the potential betterment of the relationship.
Yeah, I agree. Like, there's a lot of relationships that I have in my own life that I wouldn't necessarily call toxic, but I can say that because I've put up boundaries.
Yeah.
And I've kind of, like, drawn a line in the sand saying, all right, like, this is where we are, this is where we're going to stay, and this is the way that it will always be.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes you need that to not only, you know, because sometimes if you don't set up boundaries, it can cross line hurt other relationships. Like, for example, if you have if you're married, mm-hmm. or you're in a, you know, committed relationship with someone, and someone that, you know, another potential suitor comes along and you don't define that relationship,
right?
You're setting yourself up for things like cheating or a potential heartbreak.
Yeah.
Which can also lead to things like depression and suicide.
Yeah. 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 That's very true. Yeah. We don't always think about it like that, because I think more often in our lives, it doesn't, like, that, what you just said is blaringly obvious to most people, but having relationships that maybe are just friendships that end up being toxic are harder to identify. They're more ambiguous.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially if they, like, I know for me personally, like, some of my most toxic friendships are friendships that I had for quite some time. And they either weren't toxic or I didn't realize it until it was way too late and damage had been done.
Yeah, no, early in our marriage, Eric and I, we were talking, and there were certain relationships that I had in my own life, and she just kind of, like, looked at me and said, that's not right, and kind of, like, pointed out the toxicity.
Yeah.
And those relationships have since been mended.
Yeah.
But then you have to kind of face that toxicity, and you have to be able to say, hey, it's time we have the DTR talk.
Yeah.
We're going to define the relationships, the parameters of what is allowed and what's not allowed.
Yeah.
What I'm comfortable talking about versus, you know, where, you know, we stand as far as, like, actual friendship.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes I think in my life that the strain of that, the reality of that, is that's a one-way street.
Yeah.
The other person doesn't want to have that conversation. They don't see the flaws. They do see the flaws, but they don't care, you know, whatever. It could be a number of things. But I know in my life, like, a lot of that becomes very difficult, not just because it feels like, something we don't want to do. It feels like separation. It feels like breaking up. It feels painful, but because it feels lonely.
Yeah.
And that freaking sucks.
Oh, absolutely. But I think to your point, like, I would argue that relationships in that, like, that way that you kind of feel like lonely or like one-sided or just feel whatever, you know, singularity you want to put in that box. I think that that's not a authentic friendship, because friendships and relationships are meant to quite literally weather storms. Yeah. They are meant to be foundational. That is, you know, what's the old saying that Jesus talked about, as far as like the wise man builds his house
on a rock.
On the rock.
Yeah.
You know, a solid foundation where it's not going to come.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a friend that's closer than a brother. Yeah. Yeah, very true. All right, so the movie.
It got a little deep there.
Yeah, no, it's good.
That's why we're here, right?
Yeah, all right.
Mental health and Nicolas Cage.
That's right. In no particular order. So the movie's going along, and it's just a lot of, in the beginning when Nicolas Cage's character, Doug, first comes back into the detail, it's a lot of like piddly crap and a lot of like tete-a-tete and sort of this tug of war of frustration.
I want to say, like, coming on, like, the frustration, like, I feel like the first two-thirds of this movie are just kind of trying to, like, establish, like, the playful, like, banter.
Yeah.
And, like, almost immaturity of, like, both Tess and Doug.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
I don't know if you felt that way kind of coming into this as well.
No, yeah. It feels like sibling, almost. You know, there's that, like, yeah, it's interesting. And then there's this one scene where it all kind of just comes to a head, and it comes to a head for no reason. It's very interesting. But she essentially throws her security detail out. She throws them out of the house.
He convinced her to do that.
That's true. But for what reason?
He just didn't want to deal with her anymore.
I mean, that's fair. But it was still just, yeah. Anyway, that's kind of what it comes down to.
I mean, I can't argue with him.
Sure.
Because, like, again, having worked in toxic work environments, like, there are definitely times where, like, I've wanted to tell my boss off, or, you know, the boss that I was working for at the time, but professional courtesy.
Sure.
So. Yeah.
There's this really, if immediately following that, there's this, like, really important little part where she's, like, watching old videos. Like, it's, like, home video style, but it was, like, news bullets of, like, her husband and different congressional things and him being in office. And in every one of these videos you see in the Secret Service, there's the Doug character, Nicolas Cage's character.
Dougie!
And so they just keep happening. And even onto the funeral scene, you can see, and she's like tearing up, and it's hard. And it's like, it's the first time you get to see this character as a person, you know?
Yeah, because she's kind of treated like the bratty, like, little sister. Throughout the first two thirds of this movie,
she's like this 70 something, you know, whatever, like, little sister, it's wild. And it's interesting. So after that, there's this really funny scene where, like, Doug is sitting in his car outside because he doesn't leave. I don't know why, probably because he was yelled at by the president.
Well, he does leave.
Does he leave?
He does leave. And the reason that he comes back is because the president calls him while he's pooping.
That's right. Yes, that's true. And so he goes out. So he, like, follows the president's orders, but he doesn't go back inside because she threw them out. And so he's sitting in his car, and he's, like, pouring hot coffee from a thermos. And she just comes up and, like, taps on his window, and he just throws it everywhere. He just jumps. And it's really funny. And she just, like, he's, like, fussing at her, and she's fussing at him. And she was like, I just wanted to see if you wanted some coffee. And he was like, oh, okay. Like, he just kind of agrees to it. And that is really, really, really pivotal. It's a big turning point in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. That's the sequence where you kind of get to see them be humans, it feels like, for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild. And then they just talk, and she's like, you know, I have a drink sometimes. Coffee keeps me up, even if it's decaf. But sometimes I have a drink. Did you know that? And he's like, I didn't, you know, in his Nick Cage voice and way.
That's a great impression.
I didn't. Yeah. And she's like, you know, if I find a tumbler or something like that, would you have one? And he's like, I would, you know, kind of thing. And so they're like, have a drink, and then they go out to a bar, and she's just like, she's just spilling her guts, like, finally, just talking, just like about her husband's infidelity and things. And like, it's just this amazing, it's amazing scene, but it's also feels so random. It really feels like there's almost no build up to it.
And from a terms of a narrative perspective, I agree with you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
However, from terms of a...
like a relationship perspective.
Not only a relationship, but someone coming out of depression.
Yeah.
I would say that it feels very fitting, because the way that essentially, if you're bottling up all the emotions, because not only do you have the grief of losing a husband, you're forced to kind of be nannied for 5 years.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, we see this during the opera scene. She's like actually in like the spotlight.
Yeah.
And she's like a notable figure. It would be like the equivalent of like seeing like Michelle Obama out in the supermarket.
Yeah, that's exactly what it'd be like.
And so you kind of have to, you know, you're basically forced in that position to take all of those emotions and bottle them down until eventually that lid can't give anymore and all of those emotions spill out.
Yeah.
So that sequence that you're talking about in particular, that is an outpouring of 5 years of depression and 5 years of just bottling it in, because, you know, sometimes I think we do so much in life and we don't always hear those words, how are you doing, or are you okay? Those two questions are pivotal for someone in Tess's position.
Yeah, it's valid. Definitely valid. And then, but she just keeps talking, and she's like, all right, I've talked about myself enough. Let's talk about you. And it's just,
I wanted to know more about Doug.
Yeah, me too. And you can, like, she reveals that she knows some things just because, you know, he's under her employ, you know, so, like, she knows some things. Her husband knew things and told her, and et cetera, et cetera. And from that moment on, like, the details of it are neat, but irrelevant, really, because from that moment on, you see she wants to do things like, well, it really brings us to this big scene that you don't ever expect to be big, and it doesn't feel big the entire rest of the movie. They go on a picnic, and she's just sitting there when it's freezing outside with her yellow rose, drinking her tea by like a lake at this folding table. And she only wanted him to come, which becomes problematic in the narrative, because it's like, she shouldn't have only had one guard. But it was also just like, also on kind of a backwards end of the narrative, you see it's like really intentional that she really values him, you know, not necessarily her detail, but him as a person.
If you or someone you know is listening to this podcast right now and you're struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, we encourage you guys to please reach out. This is the heartbeat of why we do what we do. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. And as of this recording, there are 132 suicides that take place each and every day on American soil. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That is one death roughly every 40 seconds. So if you or someone you know is struggling, you guys can go to victimsandvillains.net/hope. That resource is going to be right in the description wherever you guys are currently listening or streaming this. There you'll find resources that include the National Suicide Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-8255. You can also text HELP to 741-741. We also have a plethora of other resources, including churches, getting connected with counselors, LGBT resources like the Trevor Project, and also Veteran Hotline as well. Please If you hear nothing else in the show, understand that you, yes, you listening to this right now, have value and worth. We get it. Suicide, depression, mental health, these are hard topics, and the stigma around them doesn't make it any easier. But please consider the resources right in the descriptions below, wherever you guys are listening, because once again, you have value and you have worth. So please stay with us.
Yeah, it's interesting. She like falls asleep, and you're not sure if she's asleep or not. And he checks her pulse, picks her up, puts her in the car, goes.
It's a very enduring moment.
Yeah, it's a very enduring moment. Yeah, goes back to get like the chair, and the driver just takes off.
This is the part of the movie that kind of just lost me, because it just happens to like, just at this moment, the moment that he turns back around with the chair, it's like a light switch.
Yep.
The genre of the movie just changes.
Yeah. And you know, they like, they're searching for her. She's gone. She's lost. Like, is she alive? Is she dead? Did he take her? Is she kidnapped? Like, is she joyriding? Because she joyrides at an earlier point in the movie, and when she's doing her little antics, and like almost 24 hours go by, and they find the car, and they find the driver, and he's got like little burn marks on the back of his neck, and he's been injected with something, and it's like some drug cocktail, just enough to knock him out, and she's gone. And they compare a cigarette lighter. Nicolas Cage's character is brilliant, of course, as every Nick Cage character is. And they compare a cigarette lighter to the burns on the guy's neck, and they like basically match. And so Nick Cage is like, she is defending herself. She's used the only thing she had. So they suspect the driver, and then this wild hospital scene happens.
This hospital scene probably was the best part of the movie.
That is your favorite part?
I love seeing Nicolas Cage has a wide array of ranges.
Of course.
But I love seeing him kind of like go into his signature mannerisms.
Yeah.
And this scene definitely had it, where he shot some guy's toe off and then threatened to shoot another one off. And this is where the F-bomb comes in, too.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. So basically, Nicolas Cage is just not convinced that this guy didn't do it, you know, and the guy's like defending himself and I'll get an attorney and I didn't do it. And like, and Nicolas Cage is not convinced. He's got his gun on him. There's another Secret Service agent in the room and he's like freaking out because Nick Cage is like going rogue. And the guy finally fesses up and he's like, they paid me. They made me do it. It's my, what was it, his sister and brother-in-law, or brother and sister-in-law?
Yeah.
Had, like, taken her. And she's like, they've got her in a farmhouse. A farmhouse, really? Yeah, a farmhouse, I swear. You know, it's this whole back and forth. And,
That's great impressions, man.
Thanks. Yeah, it's just, and that's where the movie goes from there, and then it ends after that part.
I don't know if you felt the same way, but like up until like the picnic scene, my thought process was, where are we going with this?
Same. Like I was expecting like everybody's going to find out, because you find out early on, a hint early on that she might have a brain tumor. And then in the second act, they confirm it.
Which there's also no resolution for that subplot.
Never, ever. But that is what you expect. That's the resolution that you expect. You expect her to, like, you know, you expect it to be kind of comedic, but mostly melodramatic, and he, like, dies at her side with, you know, as she suffers through this brain tumor kind of a thing. That's what I was expecting anyway. That just seemed to come naturally with the narrative they built. But no, they go to the farmhouse. They go there, and they find this brother and sister-in-law, and they find this big tube in the ground. They're like, she's down there, you know, and like, they just kept her alive, but buried her alive with an air supply for like a day. And it was bad. And they dug her up, and then she's like, she's not dead, but she's not conscious. And then, and there's like really sweet scene toward the end.
Yeah.
You know, and she get, they load her on this chopper, and the security detail, including Cage's character, is like going off to their cars. You know, the chopper's going to the, you know, like a hospital or something. And somebody from the chopper is like, yells out like, Doug, whatever his name. And then there's this wonderful 101 Dalmatians scene where, like, from the chopper all the way to the cars, you have one guy, or you have several guys, like, yelling his name closer and closer to the cars. It's like the beacons are lit sort of situation. And he, like, turns around, and they're like, she's awake, sir. She wants her security detail, which is, like, this sweet moment because she wants him. And, like, she didn't want them before, and now they've found her and saved her, and they go in the chopper. And the movie ends.
Yeah, this movie...
You have no idea why she was taken at all. That's never discussed.
Why she was, like, taken to the farmhouse?
Yeah.
My theory is that because they find the ransom note in the glove compartment for $15 million... My theory is that they saw, like, here is a beloved, like, we might not get the president, but this is the next best thing.
Yeah, and she's, like, vulnerable. Thing.
And
I guess that makes sense, but, like, a cash grab?
Yeah, it's look, I'm probably stretching here. It's not like I agree with it, but... Yeah,
and they even pointed out they buried her, like, deep. They were, like, somebody even said, you're a like, you weren't planning on digging her up. And so it's just like, this was all just a wild goose chase for nothing. Like, it just doesn't make, it didn't make any sense. And it didn't bring resolve to really anything.
No, it's like they had, like, I see this a lot of times when I'm reviewing movies, is like, I feel like you have, like, this, like, one idea. And then when you go into the studio, the studio's like, yes. But what if it ended like this? Like, all right, so bring it back to our conversation last month Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. If you guys haven't seen this movie yet, we're not going to spoil anything, but Cage and Pascal's character end up writing this, like, movie, and there's a scene between Tiffany Haddish and Nick Cage where she's trying to convince him to give up details on Javi's character, and... She pitches him this idea of doing a kidnapping scene, and he talks about how it would, like, change the entire plot of the movie.
Yeah.
Dude.
That's what this is.
That's exactly what this is.
Yeah. It's guarding Tess. That whole movie is just guarding Tess.
But way more brilliant.
Way more brilliant. Everything is more brilliant in this movie. You know, it's something I was waiting for, and this is just me being a sucker, because, you know, my favorite Nicolas Cage movie is National Treasure. I'm sorry, not sorry about that. It's just a fact. I was really hoping, because that, like, oh, yeah, he's in politics. He works for the president and stuff. I was really hoping to see, like, to realize that maybe National Treasure as a Nick Cage movie had called back to this movie in some way, shape, or form.
Dude, that would have been awesome. I don't think they did. No.
I don't think they did, but I was like, that would have been really cool. Because I can't think of another movie where Nicolas Cage is really that closely associated with politics or DC or anything like that. And I thought it'd be really, really neat, but it just didn't happen.
And this is a movie that, to me, like... flies under the radar, because I think when you think of Nicolas Cage in the 90s, you're like Con Air, The Rock, Face Off.
Gone
in 60 seconds, which is, you know, 2000. Like, still, like, you know, you think of these, like, really, like, high profile action movies.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
And then you get, like, little weird nuggets like Deadfall or It Could Happen to You. Yeah. And then you get movies like Guarding Tess, where you kind of get to see him flex his comedic skills, but also at the same time, like, give you just a little hint of what's to come in the future years.
Yeah. 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 That's interesting. That's a good point. Yeah. I mean, he definitely had, you probably also think of, like, was it Honeymoon in Vegas? was 90s.
95.
Yeah, it was his first. It was his first Oscar, right?
Yeah, it's well, he's got two Las Vegas movies. I was getting mixed up. So
yeah, it's Honeymoon in Vegas and Leaving Las Vegas.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of them. Yeah, and I think they're both 90s. And they're not. They're probably not what the Joe Schmo thinks of when they think Nicolas Cage in the 90s. But for Nicolas Cage's career, they actually are pretty big movies. Yeah, but you're right. You're right. You see him in these little, like, these small films. And we're going to talk about briefly about It Could Happen to You probably in a second. But I just want to, like, mention that movie, too, because, you know, we realized really early on watching this one that, like, Nicolas Cage does a really good, like, just straight-laced good guy.
Yeah.
Not good guy as in hero. Don't misread me. He's not Captain America. That's not what we're talking about.
Ooh, I would love to see a Captain America Nicolas Cage.
Me too. Anyway, look,
Marvel has opened the door for multiverses that's now.
True. I want a Marvel multiverse where Nicolas Cage gets to play every single Marvel hero throughout the multiverse.
It's just an entire universe of Nicolas Cage.
But anyway, yeah, and like, but he really does. He plays like he's just so good at just playing just like the good old boy Joe Schmo, like straight laced rule follower.
Yep.
You know, he was so much like he had a similar attitude. He was not this guy, but he had a similar attitude of that in like what's it called? In Raising Arizona. He's very much that guy in The Rock. I mean, that character didn't even swear, like, and that was Cage's choice that the character didn't swear at all. You know, It Could Happen to You. I mean, you see him like, delivering a baby in like a sub car in the beginning, and he's just like, you know,
real genuine stand-up kind of guy.
A stand-up dude, man. Like he is mild-mannered Clark Kent if he's not Superman. And it's just it's really funny in its own way, and it's very satisfying. It makes me wish that like we still got Nick Cage roles like that.
I mean, I don't think they're dead yet.
No, I don't think they're dead.
I think they're just kind of transformed to like not be quite like the straight-laced good guy, but kind of like a more traditional, like, American cinema hero.
You know, it's weird to me that, like, you know, you see all those movies like, what's that? What was those movies? Like, something, the movie like Marky Mark and they're all dads.
Are you talking about,
it's like, not Step Brothers.
Daddy's Home.
Yeah, Daddy's Home. Like, you see movies like that, or Horrible Bosses, or like 2000s and 2010s comedies that are just like, they've got these stacked casts and they work brilliantly, but all the cast members are either like, some of them like cut their teeth in like SNL and comedy, but some of them over like has been action heroes and they just, they make these hilarious freaking movies. Not necessarily good movies, but really funny movies. And I think Nicolas Cage deserves one of those. He deserves like a stacked cast where he just gets to be like a bumbling dad. And it's funny. Genuinely funny.
Mom and Dad. Wait till we get there.
Yeah? Sick.
It's not funny.
Oh.
It is it is quite an acid trip, though.
Okay.
But he does play a bumbling dad.
Okay, fun.
You want to get some trivia?
Dude, that's like my favorite part.
All right, so stars Shirley MacLaine and Nicolas Cage became great friends while filming due to their mutual love of animals. Are you ready for this?
I'm so ready for
this. And would go on to co-adopt many animals together, including a ferret named Whiskers and a zebra named Mr. Zed.
Mr. Zed?
So yes.
Not Mr. Ed.
Mr. Zed.
Oh my gosh, that makes me so happy.
George Clooney auditioned for just one line in this movie, but it never made it to screen.
What?
Yeah. I think it's rather funny. I actually don't know if you caught this or not, but you know, since we're all about Easter eggs here. The president calls Doug Chesnick to inform him that Tess Carlisle has refused Secret Service protection. The president refers to Tess Carlisle as, quote, a national treasure. ironically, Nicolas Cage starred in the National Treasure series of films.
Yeah, okay, that is, there it is. That's fair. That's gentle, probably, but that's still fair.
This is an interesting one. Official publicity for the film's pictures press kit in 1994 declared at this time of the movie that there were more former American presidents and former first ladies alive than there had ever been in the country's history.
Wow.
Director and co-writer Hugh Wilson, who was also the voice of the president in the movie.
So good.
Dude, I loved, like, when it comes to, like, cinematic presidents, like, I might not remember a whole lot about this movie, but I will remember the fact that this president loved to say GD.
Yeah, a just whole lot. Over and over again. Now, my favorite, I have a favorite on-screen president. It's not that one. But
who's, I mean, I don't know if I have a favorite on-screen, but he's definitely high up on that list. Who's yours?
Oh, mine is, man, I can never remember his name. You'll know his name. But he's is the president of Independence Day.
Oh, Bill Pullman.
Yeah, Bill Pullman. There it is. Yeah.
Fair enough.
That's my favorite on-screen president. My second favorite is Harrison Ford.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Mine would probably be the president from the Simpsons movie.
Okay.
As I quote that a lot, I was elected to lead, not to read. Director and co-writer Hugh Wilson said at this time that all of them were, quote, entitled to the protection of the rest of their lives, adding, at this very moment, there could be a whole congregant of Secret Service people sitting around Lady Bird Johnson's house or driving down Rodeo Drive with Nancy Reagan. The agent in front of their house would have a sawed-off shotgun between his knees.
All right.
I would like to know, like, how you research a movie like this. Like, because I feel like I'm curious, like, are Secret Service, like, relationships to the people they're protecting, like, this? How close is this to, like, reality?
Yeah, I've always thought of the Secret Service like those guards in front of Buckingham Palace, where they're just like, they're probably really trained, but they just are silent and they do nothing.
During doing research for this movie, writer-director Hugh Wilson, in talking with Secret Service agents, became fascinated with the way protection details function. He was especially intrigued by the dilemma presented when VIPs grow weary of the ever-watchful eye of the guards. He said, this is an invasion of privacy, no matter how delicately it's handled, which is fair.
Yeah. Wild. That's very cool that he, like, took the time. This movie doesn't seem that well-researched, in my opinion, but it's very cool to know that he did take the time to, like, talk to people in that position.
Yeah. I very much agree with you. The movie in 1995 was nominated for American Comedy Award for Funniest Actress in a Motion Picture for Shirley MacLaine.
What?
But lost out to Jamie Lee Curtis for True Lies.
True Lies is a sick movie, though. Schwarzenegger? Oh, man. I used to love that movie as a child.
Yeah. The movie was in 1995 was nominated for Golden Globe Award for Best Performance by an Actress in a Motion Picture, Comedy or Musical for Shirley MacLaine, but lost out to Jamie Lee Curtis in True Lies.
It's wild. Did people really think that highly of this film in the 90s?
I don't know.
Were there fewer films in the 90s? Like, what are we...
So I don't know, like, because, like, I mean, we were children,
very little, yeah,
in the 90s, and I think for, like, both of us, like, when you talk about, like, 90s comedies released in, like, the early
90s, oh dude, it's Ace Ventura and Mask and stuff like that. It's all Jim Carrey. Yeah
So you have, like, Jim Carrey, like, Damon Wayans was, like, a big mainstay, mm-hmm, in, like, our house. So, like, you have, like, Bulletproof, Blank Man, then you have Adam Sandler.
Oh, yeah, true.
So, but, like, you have also Chris Farley with Tommy Boy.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, like, I would just never think of, like, Nicolas Cage in roles like this. Like,
no.
Even like,
I want him in roles like this.
I'd love him in roles like this. Yeah, yeah. But I will also say at the same time, like, that's part of the reason, like, I like doing this podcast is because, like, I'm discovering that, like, Nicolas Cage is, like, all these, like, layers.
Yeah.
So it's never, like, you're just kind of, like, oh, yeah, in the 90s, he was the action guy. In the 80s, he was the quirky, weird guy that did movies like Raising Arizona and Vampire's Kiss. No, he's got, like, so many different layers to him.
Yeah. Yeah. So my wife, Emma, really loves Hot Ones.
I would love to see Nicolas Cage do Hot Ones.
Yeah. So, she watched, like, one, she said one episode that she really, really liked was, the Elijah Wood episode. And I didn't watch this. I didn't watch this episode, but she was saying that, Elijah Wood was just like, he was asked some question about like an actor who inspires him or actors who inspire him or something like that, or something he's learned a lot acting. I don't remember the question. But he said, and I mean, this is Elijah Wood. I mean, like, yeah, he only started acting in the 90s and he was a kid and he's still pretty freaking young, all things considered. But like, I mean, it's Frodo. Like, you know, like his work has mattered. Very much. And he credits like Nicolas Cage. He's like, he thought it was just fascinating to work with him and he learned so much from him and he was so like just incredible to work with. And I love to see, I don't know, I haven't seen the movie The Trust, the movie that they were in together. I don't even know what it is.
He was also producer of Mandy.
That's right. That's right. I don't know if the interview happened before or after Mandy. It may have actually been before.
But I didn't even know they worked together.
Yep, What's the Trust? Apparently, it's a crime thriller from 2016.
Interesting.
Yeah, Cage has a mustache.
Nice.
Yeah, that's good.
Coming soon to a podcast near you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. But I love stuff like that because I feel like that's kind of often. Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like that's often been Cage's sort of role. No pun intended. Is that like he's not on top of the game very often or for very long, but he persists very well. And he'll always be somebody's inspiration. He'll always have movies that will never get forgotten, you know, things like that. Like,
yeah, you will always have hobbies.
Yeah.
And Captain Nostalgias.
Right.
And VHSs.
Right.
to be inspired. So I am curious about this. So
sure.
Is Guarding Tess worthy of high praise?
I really don't think so. I really don't. I think that it has, I think that there are parts of it that are cool, that are funny, that are maybe even interesting, that are very, maybe even like heartfelt. And there's a lot to glean from this movie as we got into quite a bit earlier from like a mental health perspective. But I think and Nicolas Cage's role and character is just fine. You know, it's nothing to write home about, but it's solid. You know, being that this is a Nicolas Cage podcast, I feel like I have to say something. I have to single that out, you know, but I don't think there's much of a plot here. And I think that the plot here, the plot that is there, just changes directions suddenly and all too non-specifically. I think the movie just, there's cool things about it. But I think that third act really just loses it for me.
So this is a first for me. I can't quite say this film is worthy of high praise, but I can't quite say that it's not worthy of high praise. Because much like what you're saying, like there are quite a lot of things that this film has going for it.
Sure.
It's very delightful. I like the back and forth and the chemistry between Shirley MacLaine and Nicolas Cage. I think they do really great things together. Sure. There are very memorable scenes. But in the end, this movie just feels like very forgettable.
Yeah.
And it's kind of messy from time to time.
Yeah.
But I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
Like even when it switches the genres, it still like interested me.
Yeah, I wanted to keep watching because I wanted to keep seeing what they would do. I don't think that I was on the edge of my seat, But it was just like, all right, now that there's a tonal shift, I'm very curious because I thought I knew where this movie was going, and I guess I don't. And that was interesting for what it's worth.
Yeah, so I'm going to say, like, this is one of those movies that I would like to leave up to interpretation of the listener.
Sure.
Because I had fun with it, but I also think that this movie is, from a fun standpoint, from an entertainment standpoint, it is hesitantly worthy of high praise.
Sure.
From a narrative standpoint, it's very messy, it's very sloppy, and it's not worthy of high praise.
No.
So it has both kind of going for it. Yeah, so.
I think, again, we keep bringing this movie up as a similar time frame for Nick Cage, but I think it is, in a way, fairly comparable in tone to It Could Happen to You. Because It Could Happen to You is one way for quite some time that's fairly upbeat, some drama here and there, it's funny. It's playful, and then there's like a tonal shift, and the tonal shift is drastic and doesn't last that long before the movie ends. And the movie ends pleasantly enough.
I will slightly disagree with you there. I think that, and this is coming from someone that has seen a lot of romantic comedies.
Sure. I mean, same.
Like, to me, like, It Could Happen to You is, it has those beats where I think it lays the groundwork a lot more successfully than this film does.
No, very true. That's very true. Yeah.
So by the time it makes that tonal shift, like that ever so slightly,
you're ready.
It doesn't feel jarring.
No, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. And we both agreed that movie was worthy of high praise. We both liked that movie quite a bit. I think that you're right. I just think that, like, if you were to describe this movie to me and you were to describe that movie to me, neither, you know, upon first description and first impression, I wouldn't have expected either of the, like, tonal shifts in either of them.
Mm.
That's kind of like what I'm getting at. But yes, It Can Happen to You is written much better. It's directed much better. Its tonal shift is warranted and like, you know, you could see it coming. It's predictable, but not in a kitschy way.
Yeah.
How would you guys like to help us get mental health resources into schools, conventions, and other events? Well, now you can. Simply go to patreon.com/victimsandvillains for as little as $1 a month. You guys can help us get mental health resources into current and upcoming generations, educate, and break down stigma surrounding mental health, suicide, and depression. And you get exclusive content that you can't get anywhere else. And you guys can tell us which Nicolas Cage movie you want us to cover, and we'll do it. All it takes to get started is to go to patreon.com/victimsandvillains, or simply click the link in the episode description wherever you guys are currently listening or streaming this episode. Pick your tier and get started today. Yes, it's that simple. So quickly select the tier that you want and help us get hope into the hands of the depressed and the suicidal today.
All right, so the question remains now.
Yeah, yeah.
This movie or It Could Happen to You, which is the better 94 pick?
It Could Happen to You is the better.
Hands down.
It's better. I mean, like, there are cool things about this movie. There's some great trivia about this movie. I'm not saying that this movie isn't worth watching. I think it is. I wouldn't go out of my way to see it again myself, but I'd watch it if somebody wanted to watch it with me, you know, as a Cage fan. But I think It Could Happen to You, like, I have watched it since we did an episode on it. I do enjoy that movie.
So delightful.
It's a delightful movie. I think it ends a little fast. That's the only thing that bums me out about that movie, is I always want to see, I want the end to flesh out a little bit more than they did with it. But, like, it's just a great, wholesome movie.
Yeah.
And you still get to see Nicolas Cage, like, yell and flail and be, you know, early 90s, you know?
Yeah, I 100% agree. Like, I love It Could Happen to You. It's a movie that I wasn't expecting a whole lot from, and it surprised the ever-loving crap out of me. Whereas this film, I'm not really one for political movies, But I think that you're right. Like, this isn't a movie that, like, I would seek out to watch by myself again. But if someone was like, hey, let's watch Guarding Test, like, I probably would have a better reaction to this than rewatching something like Outcast.
Oh, gosh. Why you gotta rub that mushroom?
I mean, it's not the worst movie we've seen on this podcast, but I think that's going to do it for us on this episode. We're going to be back next month talking about 2012's Trespass to commemorate the anniversary of Joel Schumacher's death. I'm a huge Schumacher fan, and I've never seen this one, so I'm excited.
Cool. What's it about?
I have no idea. It's him and Nick. It's him and Nicole Kidman. Okay. I think it's a home invasion movie. If I remember,
is he the home invader or
the home invadee?
He's the home invadee.
Yeah, he's got glasses.
Is she the home invader?
She's the home invadee. She plays his wife.
Oh man,
I know very little about this movie, but I know the basic plot points.
I don't
but
love home invasion movies.
You what?
I don't love home invasion movies.
They're something that has to be done very well.
It's because I don't like dramas. I like horrors. If they were more scary.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
And then we got some cool things planned for the summer.
Yeah, we do.
Where can people find you online, though?
Yeah. You can find me at Mullet Stash. That is pretty much everywhere. Instagram. I don't use my Twitter much, but I think there's an underscore after that. And Snapchat. And then you can find me at VHZest on Instagram as well. I need to use that account a little bit more. That was mostly for like tapes and comics. And I've been buying comics a little bit less recently. But I still have a few I need to update on there. But yeah.
You guys can catch me. I am at Captain Nostalgia on Letterboxd. You guys can follow me on TikTok at Gent Ghostface. And you guys can follow our parent company, Victims and Villains. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, and wherever you guys get your podcasts from, where you guys can go to victimsandvillains.net, where you can find more podcasts like this, movie reviews, all of links to all of our social medias, and most importantly, our mental health resource library. So until next time, remember to keep on caging.